Looking forward to having Jeremy up the next two Sunday mornings at this hour. And he's finally going to get to finish a series he started in the fall or sometime the spring. I don't know when it was. Yeah, so you've been a good sport about that, though. Thank you. Yeah. This morning, we're going to talk about living in an uncertain world. I'm going to try to focus our minds on appropriate Christian thinking in the face of uncertainty, of unsettling events that come into our lives. Now, that we live in that kind of world is no secret to anybody. It's something that seems maybe to have been a little more openly on people's minds in the last few years. I think for our country, 9/11 is kind of the marker for a lot of people for when worrying went to a new level in this country. We've been at war with two other countries. We've got a lot of economic uncertainty that kind of traces back to that day. But really, these topics are not new. As I was thinking about this, I thought back to, I could say, for as long as I can remember. But really, it's from before I can remember, because some of the first things I can remember was the older people talking about things that I couldn't remember, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was right around the year of my birth or just before, maybe the year before I was born. And then Kennedy's assassination was the year I was born. And people were still talking about that when I could remember them talking about it some years after that. And so none of this is new. There's always uncertainty. And the common themes haven't changed at all. It's just new people saying fixed income. The generation that's saying fixed income now mocked the generation that was saying fixed income when I was a kid. It's nothing new. Low pay, high prices, fixed incomes, political ills. What in the world is going to happen? Who are you going to vote for? This is horrible. And then you add to that the personal issues that come up, personal conflict, family problems, personal problems at work. I got torpedoed at work by the guy over there that I thought was my friend, and there's that kind of uncertainty all the time. And then for the Christian, there's another level that's well beyond those more common things. We've got the added concern about persecution, ridicule, hatred directed against us for what we believe. Even if everything goes well on the worldwide scale, are we going to be allowed to participate in the good times? Even if there's no war, no natural disaster, if the economy does fine, are we going to do fine? It's becoming much more of an issue for us in this country as our faith makes us an object of ridicule in the public arena. We've had to think about things, even in how we start this church, to try and prevent lawsuits against the church, which I couldn't even have imagined in the 1960s in Somerville, Georgia. Even the people who hated church would kill you back then if you sued a church. Somebody's coming by in the night back then. And, you know, now, likelihood is the church will be sued at some point for obeying the scripture. There'll be increasing restrictions on our freedoms. The hate speech legislation is directed at churches. In Europe and in Canada, it's already illegal to pronounce homosexuality as sin, even though the Bible does it. It's a crime to read the Bible passages in some places in this world that say homosexuality is sin, and people have been persecuted for their speech under hate speech legislation in other countries, and it's coming to us. And so you get stirred up about this stuff. You know, it puts people ill at ease, you know, and you start onto this cycle of thinking, what if this happens? What if this happens? What if that happens? And then what if we respond this way because the Bible says we should, and then this happens? Well, if this kind of stuff tends to cause you to worry, today's text should offer significant help. It's Psalm 4, It's one of the shorter psalms in your Bible, which is not why I picked it, but it is short, making it remotely possible that I can get it finished in one Sunday. Psalm number 4. Let me read. Beginning in verse 1. Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. Many are saying, who will show us any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. You have put gladness in my heart more than when their grain and new wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. It can be a challenging thing sometimes to live a life of quiet contentment, to be peaceful and at ease, confident and secure. If you get your mind fixed on what's wrong in the world or what might go wrong in the world, it can be really, really hard to get your mind off of that problem onto something more positive. And many times people stay there for years and years because they just don't know how to stop the cycle. I've got to quit worrying about this. You say, I don't need to be worried about this. The Bible says not to worry about this. But it doesn't stop. And so they stay there for a long time just because maybe they don't know what to do. And spending a lot of time worrying about what might go wrong, fretting about what else is already wrong, and wanting to change but not really knowing how to change that cycle. I've noticed this trait in a lot of talk radio fans. You know, some of those entertainers on talk radio are incredibly talented at pointing out what's wrong with society. Oftentimes, even if you don't agree with everything they say, you might tune in and they're articulating something you wish you had said, or something that, like, finally somebody said that, challenging that wrong, pointing out the hypocrisy of that thing. Some of those guys are really, really good at that, and so they're very popular. And so you might not notice, if you're one of those fans, that pointing out what's wrong is about all that ever happens, which my parents called complaining when I did it. Now, when you say the world would be better if this would happen, when this is an impossibility, it is just a more subtle form of complaining of what's wrong with the world. If I say it'll all be better when this thing happens, but this thing is impossible, then all I'm doing is pointing you again in a more subtle way to the fact that it's not like you want it to be. And I'm not being positive, even though I sound like I'm being positive. It's a subtle way of pointing out what's wrong. It's a subtle way of complaining. If everything would be better if the impossible happens, well, fine. You know, what's the point of that other than to help me go, well, that's never going to happen. I'm depressed now. Being confident in the circumstances, being positive about the circumstances improving, is not the answer to having peace and contentment in your heart in this world. Because circumstances are never going to be right. Never in this world. Since Solomon wrote that there is nothing new under the sun, it was already old news. It's not going to get better in this world. You'll have ups and downs, but the world's going down. circumstances have never worked out that way in this world. It's not going to happen with the next election. It's not going to happen with the next change in the economy. It's not going to happen with the next ruling of the Supreme Court. So trying to think positively about better days coming along is not going to ever free anybody from the pitfalls of this world. And people who think that way tend to be kind of edgy and negative. And so if you're a talk radio fan and you find yourself kind of edgy and negative, connect the dots. But you don't need the radio to have that philosophy. It's a worldly philosophy. You can have it just coming from your own heart. You don't need a host. That's not the answer. It just leaves you trapped in a cycle of worry in which you're kidding yourself about being positive and you're frustrated that it isn't working out the way you would like for it to work out. Now, if you are there, this psalm is a crash course in how to fix it. It is incredibly concise, succinct. Contentment in this world, peace in your heart in this world, is attainable if you're a Christian. If you're a believer in the true God, you can have it in this world. It's not a quick fix, but it's a process. And it's a process that has a beginning point. Being confident in an uncertain world has a beginning point, and it's not where most people start. It's in verse 1. Notice the beginning point. Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. Now, the beginning point for peace and contentment in your heart in the middle of an uncertain world is this kind of prayer. Not just prayer, but this kind of prayer. This verse is a prayer in which David addresses God as the God of my righteousness, or God, my righteousness, without the of. It could be either one. He recognizes that the righteousness that he possesses as a believer came from God. God is the provider. David doesn't think of himself as somebody who has earned a better shot at life than the next guy. He knows who did the deal in his heart. God is the provider. It's his righteousness imparted to the believer. So in his distress, David not only goes to God in prayer, but he goes to God in prayer understanding who he's talking to. He goes with a recognition of who God is. This is the God who has already solved my most fundamental problem, the worst problem that I ever had, the problem that plagues this world and brings on all these circumstances that stir things up, is sin. And this is the God who has dealt with mine. He solved the sin problem. He's the God of my righteousness. I can't have any righteousness unless God gives me some. I can't have any righteousness for him to be the God of unless he has intervened and dealt with my sin. But he did that, and he provided a substitute. He punished my sins and did away with them. So God has dealt with my sins. He solved my problem. He's the God who granted me a blessing that is greater than any other blessing. He's made me righteous. Not only did he absolve me of guilt, he didn't just put the penalty away and leave me in limbo. He put the penalty away and he made me righteous. He imparted to me this right standing with him. I'm in good with the judge. This is a blessing. This is a separate thought, at least, from the guilt being set away. I'm now forever made righteous by his work. He gave me this good thing. He gave me this package of good things that included being rid of my sin and now being made righteous. He's already done this for all who believe. If I get nothing else in this life, I'm good. This is big. Now, when you pray in times of trouble, this is the God that you're going to. This isn't a psych yourself up kind of game. This isn't the humanistic attitude of, if I think positively, good things will happen. This is reality. This is who He is. The difference is not that now God has become this or God has changed. The difference is this man who wrote this psalm understood who God was. He's going in prayer with a recognition of the true nature of God, and that's the beginning point for you to have contentment and peace. Now, if you know this, then you can keep going, because if this God is so great and so wonderful to me that He would eliminate my sin and grant me righteousness, if He's willing to pay the high price that we know it took to make that transaction, then why wouldn't He provide me these insignificant things that keep me awake at night? What am I thinking when I'm fretting over a few dollars? And the God who owns everything was willing to give His Son for me. If He'll give that great thing, why wouldn't He give me a small thing when I need it? Why wouldn't He provide the short-term things in this world? His character is proven already. He's the God who has met my need, my most basic need. So why shouldn't I trust Him for the lesser things, the temporary things, the provision, the protection, the stuff that stirs me up? Why shouldn't I be able to say, well, if He can handle that, He can handle this. So I'll just relax. Going to God is the starting point, but going understanding this is the God we're talking about. If this is all you do, this will do wonders. This is the first step in the process, but it's a big step. It's the starting point. Can't skip this. If you don't know who God is, nothing else you apply will stick very long, because the circumstances are always churning. Now, in this prayer, David expresses confidence in God based on past history. Sometimes it helps to remind yourself that God has gotten you through other things like this. And David remembers God's faithfulness in this first verse. He also makes a specific request for grace in this first verse to be applied to him, and he asks that God would hear his prayer. I mean, he's going boldly. Answer me when I call, O God. Do you pray that boldly? You who live after the cross. This is bold. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. Next, David articulates the problem that he faces. This is the immediate, visible problem that would tend to stir you up. His is in the category of big stuff, bigger stuff in this world. Verse 2, O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? What David is facing when he writes this psalm is the biggest problem for any believer. It's not the money. It's not the natural disasters. It's not the political turmoil. It's the persecution. It's the hatred directed at you because of your faith. He's grieved at the wickedness of this world and at the impact on him that that wickedness has. This is personal. I'm troubled by your hatred of the truth. That's not you personally, the people around him, the world. It bothers us when the world hates us for our faith. You know, we're trying to help. We love them and they hate us. They ridicule our faith. They call evil good and good evil. What is honorable, they make a reproach. What is reprehensible, they glorify. And man, they are good at putting a veneer on it. Smooth. And that's what David is saying. How long will my honor become a reproach? How long are you people in the world going to call what is right for me to love a narrow-minded, bigoted, whatever other names you want to apply to religious convictions? How long is that going to go on? How long will you love what is worthless and kid everybody about it, aiming at deception, pretending it's pretty, putting a veneer over sin and making it look lovely? How long? But notice the way David talks about this thing that we all battle with in this world. He says, how long will you do this? Instead of, I hope God burns you, man, or some other similar complaint, or you're going to hell, man. If you think that, you're a fool. He doesn't do that. He says, how long are you going to do this? He's calling them to change. He is complaining, but, maybe that's not the right word. He is pointing out the struggle, but in pointing it out, he's still asking them to come where they need to come. How long are you going to be this way? Don't you see what you're doing? He's calling them to wake up, to see that their values are upside down, crying out, come to your senses. This doesn't make any sense. Now, this is a significant factor in your contentment. If the lost people around you have become your enemies in your mind, then you're not going to be comfortable. You multiplied enemies for yourself. They're not evangelistic prospects for you, where you'll look with hope to see which hearts God is going to open to the gospel, but instead you got enemies all around you. That's not comfortable. It's hard to be at peace if you hate these people. Jesus said, love your enemies. So if you call them enemies, do you love them? If they make themselves your enemies, love them. But don't make them your enemies. Don't you do it. We might wonder why we're not just like them if we stop and think. Instead of hating them for what they love, we might humble ourselves and say, wow. And this is where David goes in the next verse. Here's why we're different. He's still talking to the lost people, if I'm reading this right. There's no paragraph break here. But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. David's not saying, I'm right and you're wrong. My way's better than your way. Try my way. He's saying, understand this. I'm the way I am because God changed me. And he hears my prayer. Just a forthright proclamation that puts the glory on God and still leaves David a confident man. God hears my prayer. There's a note of gratitude in your life if you can say this way. I'm the way I am because God changed me. I'm not better than you. I'm not hot stuff. When we recognize that we would be just like those people if God had not intervened in our hearts, then we glorify him, we're grateful to him, and we can resist hating the lost. What's to hate? I mean, what's for us to hate? Let them make themselves our enemies if they will, but let's not start it. God set us apart for his purposes, and he'll hear us when we cry to him. Oh, we don't know what he's doing, but he knows. And he has a purpose in it. There's that in this verse 3 too. God has a purpose. He called me out. He had a reason for doing that. When he did it, he hears my prayer. Now this is kind of in the category of example, this first part of the psalm. And even in David's example in this opening part, we have very good instruction regarding how to handle uncertainty. You go to God knowing who God is. You call the lost to repentance without hating them. You recognize God's grace in setting you apart. You rest in his purposes, knowing that he's got a reason for everything that he did, and you're wrapped up in that, but he's met your biggest need. In the next verses, we get specific instructions regarding how to handle uncertainty. Verses 4 and 5, it says, "Tremble, but do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord." Now, the Hebrew verb at the beginning of verse 4 means to quake or to tremble. Most other translations beside the New American Standard put "be angry," but that is interpretive. The word means tremble or quake. And so here, it's a little broader than just be angry. Angry certainly fits here, but it's not the only thing that fits. You probably have a footnote that says literally quake or something along those lines. You might be excited and trembling with anger. You've been there, I know. You don't have to tell me about it, but I know. But you can also be trembling with fear, can't you? Or frustration. It's not quite angry. I just don't know what to do. And I don't like it. Well, the idea is your emotions come into play and you don't really have the ability to stop them, right? I mean, circumstances mash the buttons and your emotions respond to the buttons. That's just how it works. So tremble, but don't sin. You're still responsible for how you act when your emotions go haywire in the face of circumstances. Tremble, yeah, okay, that's not sin, but don't sin. Don't respond sinfully to these emotional things that flare up in your life. Then it says, meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Literally, it says, speak in your heart. Have a self-talk on your bed all by yourself while you're laying there not sleeping. Talk about what's really true in your heart. Go over what you know about God. Go over how He's been faithful to you. Conquer your trembling by thinking of the Lord and what's true. Remind yourself of these things and it'll settle you down and you won't respond to the emotions in some kind of sinful reaction. Verse 5 is about continuing with some consistency as the world boils around you. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust the Lord. Be faithful, live a holy life, keep right on worshiping Him. Offer the sacrifice of a righteous life in the face of whatever has you stirred up. Stand firm. Continue living for the Lord and trust Him. Now that's the answer offered to the believer in this psalm. This is the crash course in how to deal with an uncertain world. You start with God, you understand who He is, you go boldly to Him in prayer asking for His grace, you cry out to the world to change these upside-down values. You point out to them where they are, but you do it in love. You remember that it is God who has kept you all this time. You talk to yourself to get yourself calmed down. You speak truth in your heart. This is a great solution to the problem of fretting over the world, right? I mean, you go, yeah, that would work. Now, the only problem with this is those troubles don't usually go away, and the fretting doesn't usually go away with just one application, right? I'll stand in front of the line. It comes around again, and I do it again, okay? 73 times on this subject I've done this, you know. I lost count on all the other subjects, but this one doesn't come up much, so I know it's less than 100. It comes around again, right? It may be from those around you. You get additional feedback from the sons of men when you say, "How long will my honor become a reproach?" And the additional feedback is on a whole new level, and you go, "Whoa, this is hard." Or it may be that you're doing pretty good and then the circumstances just turn your life upside down again. Verse 6 puts it into words this way. Many are saying, who will show us any good? Now here's the idea. And I've heard all this talk about trusting God, and it all sounds really good, and theoretically I'm sure that that works, but my circumstances are still not what I want. Show me some good. I don't want to live by faith. Show me. Who will show us any good? I don't like this having a trust. I want somebody to fix it so I can see it. Things are still not like I wanted them to be. Show me some better things. Now that's what wells up in our hearts when stuff comes around again or stuff intensifies. And the rest of this psalm is the remedial course for those of us who are normal and how to deal with this topsy-turvy world. David is praying again, the rest of verse 6. Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. When it all gets stirred up again, you go back to Him. When your heart says, show me, you go back to Him. The answer lies in God. It does not lie in your circumstances. And so when your heart says, show me, your heart is saying, you know, if we could just fix these circumstances, everything would be fine. That's where the answer is. Start a talk radio show. It'll be popular. That's not where the answer is. And so you got to go back to God. David prays again. What is he praying? Let me know you. Show me yourself. Instead of show me the better circumstances, David says, show me who you are. Lift up the light. That's visual, isn't it? That's show me. Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. If we'll delight in His greatness, we'll find good. So David prays again. Let me know you. Let me see who you are. Let me in on the brilliance of your being. Show me the light. Now everybody would like to be comfortable, right? I read an article this week. Some guy's in political hot water for being too confrontational in a small town. And then the article quoted him as saying, I like confrontation. And I thought, what an idiot. You like it? Everybody, except that one guy, who may have been drunk when he said that, everybody else would rather be comfortable, right? But the mature still ask for God Himself because they know that's the only solution. The answer is not in the circumstances. Now, if you apply this remedial course, when it wells up again, which it will, you intensify your prayer, you focus your attention, and show me who you are, O God. Here's what happens. Verses 7 and 8. You have put gladness in my heart more than when there grain and new wine abound. In peace I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. Now, he's looking at these people who are fixed on circumstances, and he sees how happy they are when the circumstances are really good. More than, he said, you put gladness in my heart, more than when there grain and new wine abound. Now, it's an agricultural economy. If you're thinking in terms of grain, and new wine, you're thinking harvest. You know, it only comes in once a year, per crop anyway. And so if it abounds, then that year you make what you would normally make in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. This would be like you're getting your bonus that you didn't even really know if you were going to get a bonus this year. And your bonus was a year's salary in addition to your salary, or 2 years' salary in addition to your salary. This would be an abundant harvest. When you have a really good year, you have more than twice as much as a normal year. And David is seeing this kind of happiness in those good years, and he says, "You have put gladness in my heart that exceeds their happiness in their best circumstances." This is where you're going if you really want God to show you who He is. So then what happens? Based on that confidence in God, David looks at his future and lies down to sleep. And sleeps. "In peace I will both lie down and sleep." And there have been nights when that second one just wouldn't come. Why can he sleep? If you've read your Old Testament, you know how many troubles David had. Why can he sleep? How could you be a king during good times and sleep, let alone face what he faced and expect to get a good night's sleep? "You alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety." The answer is not in your circumstances. The answer is in knowing who God is and what God does in this world. Trust Him. Know Him so you can trust Him. Now, I want to ask y'all some... I'm going to ask y'all some quick questions. Does this psalm remind you of any New Testament passages? Good. That's a good one. Anybody else? Yeah, that's a good one. Anybody else?
1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6 and 7. "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in the proper time, casting all your anxiety on Him because He cares for you."
Yeah, that's a good one. Anybody else? Or you can go again. That is so true. Peter sleeping and the angel pokes him with the stick. "Wake up, we're leaving." That's good. Somebody living it. I thought of Matthew 6, 31 through 34. "Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." Why is this so hard for people? You're not going to tell me it's not hard, because I'm not buying it. So why is this so hard for people? Can't be just me. If it is, why is this so hard for me? Come on, come on. The uncertainty?
Yeah, you don't know what's going to happen.
You can't plan. Yeah. Yeah, God made us without knowledge of the future, didn't he?
Most people do have different hard circumstances before, so they certainly don't think about their hands to avoid. And that's a lot of times what you're trying to do is trying to avoid that.
You know, that is a great point. A lot of times, little kids don't have a capacity for worry. You know, they're ready to dive into your arms. They believe you'll catch them. You know, if you ever look away and a kid goes thump behind you, you know, well, they're learning. It wasn't faith. It was, they're just naive, right? They don't know what can happen. So you got to grab them all the time. Stop. Don't do that. And as we get older, we have more and more bad experiences, and we can respond to them by habitually just, oh, what's coming? What if this happens? What if this happens? So we get fixed on the physical and the tangible, right? I mean, I think that's an attention issue, which is what David was saying in this psalm, or what he was demonstrating in this psalm. His attention kept going back to God, and he could settle down. We live in a pretty affluent society. Most of the time, we don't feel affluent because we're usually mortgage poor or car payment poor or some other kind of artificial poor. Huh? Well, yeah, we got an awful lot to feel poor, I'll tell you that. All of us do. But there are, you know, we all see people who have a lot more, too. And I used to work in finance and knew a lot of people with multiple millions of dollars. And so I ask you a question. The answer may be obvious. Is it possible to have great wealth and comfort and still struggle with this fretting? Can you have everything everybody else wants in the physical and tangible world and still be trapped in worry? Why is that? How does that work if you're rich? Some of you rich people speak up. I mean, feel free. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you know, they
put too much trust in what they have. Not enough trust in God.
David was a king, but still struggled with it.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of people like that. You know, if you have it, then what are you afraid of? Yeah, I got to keep this. When I was in college, I took a tennis class, and in the class we had a tournament, and there was one guy in the class that was the king of the whiners. You know, and we were all pretty tired of his whining by the time the tournament got sort of advanced, and we were two or three games away from the end of it, and he moved up into the number one slot, and he complained. Because in his mind, it was harder to be in the number one slot because now everybody was gunning for him. And it would be much comfortable for him if he could be in the number two slot, because then all he had to do was win the last game, and he'd have it without all this stress. And I said, just lose. You'll have everything you want. I mean, it was the stupidest thing I had heard in a long time, but he really, I mean, he meant it. And this is what happens when you've got a lot of stuff. You're not going to give it away so you don't have the stress. And God forbid the preacher should suggest it. But I can't be content either. It would be so much easier to have less, but don't you try to get it. Fixed on stuff knows no economic boundaries. The problem is fixing on stuff. It's where your attention is. What's the significance of verse 8? Back at Psalm 4. What do you get out of verse 8? Peace of mind. Is there anything in that verse that... That's right. There's one word in the latter part of verse 8 that I think is a key issue that we often miss, miss in our practical living of life. It's the word alone, in this translation anyway. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. Christians fall into this God plus trap. You know, Lord, I love you, and I want you, but I want that new car too, okay? Contentment will be God and then you fill in the blank, and you're back in the cycle. You're fixed on the circumstances, but you're kidding yourself. It's a God alone issue. And that's the victory. Start to finish, it's God. Got to know who He is, and you got to trust Him. I better stop so y'all can eat. There's a lot of food back there, and Ronnie doesn't want to take any home. So let me lead us in prayer.